What do you like? Fed policy, blueberries, or the musings of Yanis Varoufakis? Because us? Yeah, we got them all. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In New York, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Wednesday, the 27th of April. Glad, as always, to have you along, everybody. A pause as we begin to note the conclusion of the least anticipated meeting of the Federal Reserve in a good long while. Dr. Yellen and company wrapped up a two-day meeting today, bupkis on interest rates, which we all knew going in. They did say, though, that the labor market is improving and inflation's picking up, even as growth in the economy overall seems to be slowing down just a bit. Do with that what you will. Till the next meeting anyway, 14th and 15th of June. From the pages of the Wall Street Journal today, this item: Comcast is in talks to buy DreamWorks Animation. There is no confirmation from either side, it must be said, but it is, if true, yet another sign that Comcast is becoming more than just another cable company. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has that one.
Despite all the cord cutters, Comcast added customers and profits this quarter. But the company has been making moves for a while to be more than a provider of cable and internet.
They're not just a distributor, they're not just a cable company.
David Miller follows the media industry for Topeka Capital Markets. He says Comcast has moved from just owning the distribution hardware to the distribution medium as well.
They own NBC Universal, they own the NBC Broadcast Network, they own a suite of cable networks like USA and Sci-Fi, all the Bravo networks. And, of course, they're involved in the theme parks business.
The next step, the content that's on those channels and marketed in those parks. Ali Yurakoglu teaches economics at Stanford.
Most of the content they deliver to consumers isn't produced by themselves. It's produced by suppliers. But recently, they've been getting into integrating into that content production sector.
Frank Louthan of Raymond James & Associates says doing that helps bring down costs.
One of the biggest costs for cable companies is actually the content that they pay. This gives them a little bit of hedge on that cost that's been rising every year.
Plus, when Comcast owns a franchise, say Universal's Despicable Me, the company gets to keep all the associated revenue in-house.
So everything that a content company would own, all the licensing and merchandising, all the syndication and so forth, they would control all of that as well.
So adding that catalog of content can look pretty appealing. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
There's the minutia of high finance that is dull and boring, and then there's the minutia of high finance that is honestly kind of fascinating. Back in February, hackers stole $81 million from the Bangladeshi Central Bank, money that was in an account at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, which, near as we can tell, got a legit-seeming funds transfer request and sent the money off to the Philippines. The request, that transfer request, likely came through something called the SWIFT system. And yeah, it was not totally legit. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains.
So you may not have heard of SWIFT, but it's a massive part of our global financial system. Bill Nelson is with the Financial Services Information Sharing and Analysis Center.
This is a closed network used by mostly banks to communicate. Might be balance information, it might be a payment instruction.
More than 11,000 financial institutions use SWIFT, a cooperative based in Belgium. It doesn't actually move money. It's the messaging platform banks use to talk amongst themselves. Stephen Cobb, a researcher for ESET North America, says it appears the hackers used compromised credentials to access SWIFT's network, then malware to cover their trail so they wouldn't be immediately detected.
So in the expanding universe of big breaches and criminal hacks, this stands out. Here you've got a very focused, specific attack on a system where it's possible to move hundreds of millions of dollars illegitimately.
SWIFT has already issued a fix for the malware and is working with its customers to improve their security. Fred Kate is a law professor at Indiana University. He specializes in information privacy and security law, and he says this focus on end users is key.
It only takes one vulnerable link in the chain. So it doesn't matter if you secure the entire chain. If there's a vulnerability someplace, eventually a bad guy's going to find it.
Kate says more than the amount of money taken, a greater cost would be if, down the road, banks or their customers lose confidence in the system. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Even the New York Fed can get fished. Think about that for a minute. Little of this, little of that on Wall Street today. Details, numbers, you know the drill. I spent a couple of days last summer walking around the streets of Athens, Greece, talking to people about what was, at that point, supposed to be the end of the Greek debt crisis, a European bailout, reforms by the Greek government, painful reforms, but at least things were supposed to have been settled. As we know, they are not. The Greek debt crisis is still with us. Europe is still having problems with its economic integration. The more things change, it seems, the more they stay the same. Perhaps the highest profile figure of that period last year was the Greek finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis. He made no friends among his European Union counterparts and did not seem especially troubled by that. He lays out his theory on what's wrong with the European Union, hint, it's money, and what he suggests might be the way to fix it. In his latest book, it's called And the Weak Suffer What They Must. Thanks for coming on the program.
It's great to be on this show.
You say pretty early on in this book that the U.S. ought to be furious with the Europeans, that Europe is too important for us to leave it to the Europeans. I can't imagine that that's playing really well over there.
You can imagine that it doesn't make me particularly popular in Brussels. But then again, that was never my intention. My intention is to do whatever it takes to arrest the slide of Europe into a new abyss. It's very reminiscent of the 1930s, an abyss that will make life of Europeans very difficult and will inflict substantial damage upon the rest of the global economy.
All right, so let me ask you a couple of specifics. And first of all, how much change has actually happened? You know, since, say, 2008 or maybe 2010, there has been much back and forth between Greece and its European creditors. Has anything of substance actually changed, or are we having the same debate all over again?
I'll give you a very radical answer. The answer is no. Nothing of substance has changed. We carry on extending the crisis into the future by pretending we've solved it. And Greece should not be, or would not be, something that you and I would be talking about in California, in New York State, anywhere else in the world. It shouldn't matter that much. The only reason why it matters is because it reflects the wholesale denial of the European Union concerning the unsustainability of the institutions that it has created.
Well, since you clearly don't, judging by your writing in this book, expect any quarter to be given from Wolfgang Schäuble, the German finance minister, or Angela Merkel, his boss, why not then advocate for Greece to go back to the drachma, get the heck out of Europe, and move on its own way?
For the very simple reason that it's one thing to say we should not have gotten into this mess, into this monetary union, and it's quite another to say that we should get out. When you leave, you don't go back to where you would have been had you not entered. You fall off a cliff. Or to put it more succinctly, it's the Eagles doctrine, the Hotel California.
You can check out
any time you like, but you can never leave.
President Obama was over in Europe last week, gave a couple of speeches, talked extensively about the upcoming Brexit vote in June, the Brits possibly leaving the European Union. You want the Brits to stay in?
Yes, because they can't get. They are under the spell of the Hotel California dictum themselves. It's a huge mistake to think that the European Union is a given. It's not a given. It is in a state of disintegration, a process of disintegration, and Brexit will accelerate this disintegration. This disintegration, when accelerated especially, is going to give rise to deflationary forces that are going to consume Britain as well as the rest of Europe. Now, how smart is that?
Well, we're in then clearly some pernicious cycle of threats to leave and patching things up, whether it's the Greeks, whether it's the Brits come June. What is the answer then to the European dilemma?
We have to fix the European Union, and we can do it technically. We can do it within a few short weeks. This may sound a bit strange. Oh, technically we can. There's no difficulty in stabilizing the European economy. It's not a lack of money. The difficulty is getting our leaders together, resolving their coordination failure problem, and having the political will to do it.
Who's culpable then? Is it Angela Merkel? Is it apparatchiks in the bureaucracy? I mean, where does blame lie for this? If the solution is as easy as you say, sir, where does the blame lie for not getting it done?
To all of them. to all political leaders, I'd never indulge in biblical economics, in moralizing, in pointing fingers and saying it's the Germans' fault, the French fault. All of them are in it together. Every single one of them, the Greek prime minister, the French president, the Portuguese prime minister, they all have a moral duty to get together and actually do that which is possible and which is absolutely essential in order to arrest this decline.
Yanis Varoufakis was the Greek finance minister. His new book is called And the Weak Suffer What They Must, Europe's Crisis and America's Economic Future. Sir, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
When the price of whatever it is that your industry produces drops, then surely as night follows day, your industry is going to produce less of it. That's the basic story of oil the past year and a half, where crude's precipitous decline means hundreds of thousands of people who used to work in the oil business aren't anymore, and a lot of smaller energy companies are in a foot race against bankruptcy. Most oil fields in this country have seen a drop in production, but not until now. Not the Permian Basin of West Texas, the highest producing oil field in this country. Marfa Public Radio's Lauren Madelon has that story.
The din at a frack operation near Midland, Texas, is the soundtrack of a technology that's allowed the U.S. to cut its dependence on foreign oil.
This is the heart of the operation right here.
Sam Sledge is an operations manager at ProPetro, a drilling services company. He walks me through a field that's been transformed. Miles of pipes, trucks, 2,500 horsepower pumps, and dozens of scurrying workers. Sledge says the market's hurting, but the technology of what's called the horizontal play is still working. Horizontal play means you drill down, then sideways, horizontally, extracting crude along the drill.
It's just been a bunch of trial and error with this new horizontal play in West Texas over the last 5 to 10 years to just dial it in to where we're going to get the most out of the rock as possible.
Sledge brings us into a trailer arrayed with computers and real-time charts. They monitor the flow in the pumps connected to the well.
14 different pumps on location, shift gears, throttle up and down, all of that is where you can control the horsepower from right here.
And the industry's improving its efficiency with technology that pins down exactly where the oil is, which means more fracks are successful. So despite low prices and a plummeting number of rigs working in the basin, oil production has climbed. From 1.8 million barrels per day in April 2015 to 2 million today. Fewer companies are doing the work, but those that remain will benefit from those that don't.
I mean, right now it's a pretty simple battle for market share. It's in our best interest to survive because the companies that are going out of business are going to in turn give us their business when we turn back around.
Until then, survival means slashing costs.
The first thing you do is you get on the phone with everyone you do business with and you try to get a cut rate.
Russell Gold's the author of The Boom, How Fracking Ignited the American Energy Revolution and Changed the World.
You make the case that, look, this is a major recession for the oil field, and everyone's got to cut.
Here's ProPetro's CEO, Dale Redman.
It's going to work itself out. It is a cycle, and just about the time everybody says it's over, it comes back.
Redman takes the long view.
You have to look at this as a marathon, not a sprint.
He says downturns mean companies like his need to forge an even deeper partnership with customers who have financial woes of their own.
You have to be in tandem with what they're trying to accomplish, and you better understand what their internal rate of returns are to get those costs down where they can continue.
Many people ask, why don't producers cut production to restrict supply and thereby raise prices? Turns out it's not so easy. Again, Russell Gold.
They need to have cash coming in the door to pay off their loans. They can't just simply stop drilling. If you stop drilling, the cash stops coming in.
Critics have called it a drilling treadmill. It means that even in the face of an oil glut and low prices, those who want to try and make money later have to at least try to stay in the game now. In Midland, Texas, I'm Lauren Madelon for Marketplace.
Lauren's story came to us from Inside Energy. That's a public media collaboration focused on this country's energy issues. Coming up.
With our organic blueberries right now, we spend the most money per acre growing them, and we can make the most money per acre selling them if things go right.
As with farming always, things going right is a very big if. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials up 0.25% today, 51 points, 18,041 on the blue chips. The S&P 500 ticked up about 0.1%, 3 points, 2,095. The NASDAQ, however, comma, shaved off 0.5%, 25 points, 4,863. Word from the Fed that interest rates are going to remain unchanged gave financial firms a boost. Goldman Sachs took home 0.2%. Morgan Stanley climbed 0.4%. Earnings told the bigger story, though, starting with Facebook shares were down slightly during regular trading, and then came the earnings report. Growth, growth, and more growth. Boom. Facebook shares clicked up around 7% after the bell. No such fun for Apple, though. Yesterday, it reported its first quarterly revenue drop in 13 years. Today's shares sliced off more than 6%, and you are listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Unless you're a white male, jobs in the NFL, that is, the jobs that don't require helmets and pads and freakish strength and speed, those jobs have been hard to come by. Since 2003, there has been a rule that obliges teams to interview minority candidates for head coaching and other senior-level jobs. This past February, the NFL said it would create a similar rule for women, and one team in particular has said it's taking that rule and running with it. The rule is known, well, it's known as whatever Marketplace Jed Kim says it's known as.
Actually, we'll let Ferris Bueller's Day Off tell us the name.
Rooney.
Rooney!
Rooney, the Rooney Rule. It's named for Dan Rooney, former owner of the Pittsburgh Steelers, which has a history of placing minorities in leadership roles.
You see a lot more minorities in front office roles, in head coaching roles, and I think the goal of the Rooney Rule is working well right now.
Michael Colangelo is associate director of the USC Sports Business Institute. He says the NFL's push to expand the Rooney Rule to bring female candidates into front office interviews, that's to be expected.
They're growing their female fan base. And when you do something like that and people become fans of the sports industry, it's a natural progression for these people to try to get jobs in something that they love.
The San Francisco 49ers, though, are going from
Rooney
to
Rooney.
That is full Rooney. The team says it's going beyond the NFL's call and will interview women for all business side jobs. Hannah Gordon is general counsel for the Niners, and she says it's all about being competitive.
What we're looking to do on the business side is really no different than what we do in the draft. You're looking to find the absolute best talent, and in order to do that, you have to make sure that you're removing your own unconscious biases. So that's why our scouts make sure that they're checking every small school, that they leave no rock unturned, and that's really what we're trying to do as well.
San Francisco is the first team to sign on with the updated Rooney Rule, which means if there is a wealth of business talent to be had, the 49ers could be ahead of the gold rush. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
A year ago this week, almost 9,000 people were killed and 500,000 homes were destroyed by an earthquake in Nepal. Billions of dollars in aid was promised but has yet to be fully delivered, tied up in domestic politics. The BBC South Asia correspondent Justin Rowlett, who we talked to from Nepal in the days after that earthquake, has gone back to see what's what.
I'm driving out into the countryside and through one of the worst hit areas, Sindal Palchuk. Here you realize Nepal is still a country of tarpaulins, tents, and tin-roofed shacks. But it isn't for want of money. In the weeks after the quake, the world came together in sympathy, pledging $4.1 billion to help rebuild the country. So why have ordinary people like Bailey Bishta and her family received practically nothing?
Every day?
Every day, yeah.
When we met her and her three children last year, the family was in deep mourning. She'd lost her husband and her mother-in-law. A year on, and the family is, like millions of Nepalese, still living in flimsy temporary accommodation. We've lost everything, she told me. No one has helped us. I've had to sell our land. It is the only way we could manage.
Mr. Prime Minister.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Even the Prime Minister admits progress has been way too slow.
Of course, it's slow, it's late, I'm not happy, but it is reality.
When will we see them rebuilt?
As soon as possible.
They're angry, they're bereft.
But the Nepali people, if anything else, also read the newspapers.
Kanakmani Dixit is a leading Nepali journalist.
We did okay in rescue and relief, international community, Nepal government, Nepali people. But then the politics of constitution writing took over. And it was a very polarizing event. We also did not have local government authorities to help out. As a result, the people were left to their own devices. Money that was here was not distributed. And then we had the constitution written, was followed by a blockade. A humanitarian crisis brought on its own.
And the suffering of the Nepali people will continue. Vulnerable in their temporary homes, they know the summer monsoon will hit in just a couple of weeks.
The BBC's Justin Rowlett in Nepal for us. The weather up in the Pacific Northwest has been pretty good so far this spring. Welcome news for blueberry farmers in Washington State who are looking at a harvest worth a cool $100 million or so. But weather being weather, cold snaps are a threat all the way till early June. So farmers wage epic battles against frost. From Prosser, Washington, Anna King of the Northwest News Network has our story.
Cold bites at night. That's the frost alarm. It looks retro, like a radio from the 1940s. It sends workers scrambling from their beds when temps drop too low. Boots on, up and out, to save tender fruit buds. Farm supervisor Arnulfo Munoz says the alarm is a bit tough on his marriage. His wife is not a fan.
Oh, every time she feels cold outside, she says, oh, the alarm again? Are you going to sleep or are you going to let me sleep?
A skeleton crew of farm workers rattles out with the first alarms to drive around the pitch black fields. Keith Oliver oversees hundreds of acres of valuable fruit here at Olson Brothers Ranches.
With our organic blueberries right now, we spend the most money per acre growing them and we can make the most money per acre selling them if things go right.
Here's the battle plan. Workers find the coldest spots, then scramble to start irrigation sprinklers. It sounds weird, but spraying water takes a bite out of the cold. Then giant wind machines turn over to life, and workers light up hundreds of propane heaters. Timing the cold war each night is key. Wake workers up and start burning lots of fuel too soon?
It's like, burning money.
Thousands of dollars per hour. Start the fight too late, even one night. Major crop fail.
So see how there's little circles of darker green?
Which is why at Washington State University, scientist Gwen Hotzheitzel is spending a lot of time deliberately freezing down hundreds of blueberry buds. He wants to know exactly when they die. She takes a razor and slices a bud open. Inside are bitty orbs of green.
They're almost like half a size of a pinhead, little tiny circles of green inside the bud part.
She's looking for signs that the frost won the fight.
Well, when they're dead, they're little pinheads of brown.
The moment those tiny bits of green die, it's a really complex thing to predict. You have to account for sunny days, cold nights, how much rain, wind, and cloud cover there is. It's a guessing game now, but Hotzheitzel is recording thousands of different scenarios into her computer model to help farmers. She thinks it's going to take 10 years. Back amid the blueberries, this is Oliver's 31st spring battling frost on this same fertile ground. His blue eyes are mostly bloodshot, determined.
We go for it. We don't want to give up on the year in the spring. We're going to fight the frost.
In June, frost retreats. Then farm workers get ready for harvest and sweltering 100-degree desert temps. In Prosser, Washington State, I'm Anna King for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, the House of Representatives voted to make the bison, the buffalo, the national mammal of the United States. It makes sense in that bald eagle kind of way, iconic, brought back from the endangered list. Also, buffalo were vital to the economic subsistence of Native Americans. But, I mean, aren't humans the national mammal of the United States? All right, we're a little tight, so I'll just say it was mixed on Wall Street today. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.